there. This is Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley. It's a podcast about making things up and making things happen. Creative people and what makes them tick and keep going is what I love to talk about. But I'm not talking about that today because this is a special episode. This is a crossover episode with my friends Dave White and Alonzo Duraldi. They're old friends of mine that I've known since the early 90s. I went to their first wedding in Dallas in like 98, 97, something like that. Anyway, they're both film critics, and they have a podcast called Linoleum Knife, and they do movie reviews and so forth, but they also have special episodes that they do for their Patreon subscribers, and one of those shows is called Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife, and they will do a deep dive of a classic movie. And for Xanadu, they thought I might be a fun guest to have on because I love that movie. I have a long history with that movie. It gets better and worse every time I see it. So they asked me to be a guest on their Xanadu episode of Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife as part of their Patreon package. So I was thrilled to do it, of course. I recorded it when I was in Palm Springs doing the Mismatch game. And when Dave and Alonzo asked me to do this, I started writing down all the Xanadu memories I have of just times I've seen the movie, special screenings, shirts I made, the Broadway show. Like, I have a lot. There were a lot. I was like, wow, I have a lot of fodder for this. So that's what this episode is. They're letting me play it as part of my podcast, but hopefully you will love them so much that you will start listening to their podcast, Linoleum Knife, and become a Patreon supporter of theirs. So check out Linoleum Knife on Patreon for all their bonus stuff. They're delightful, and I had so much fun talking about Xanadu with them. But before we get to that, I want to remind you that this podcast, Dennis Anyone, is brought to you by me. I do it because I love it. I find it really fun and fulfilling, and more so as time goes by. I'm super into it. So if you like what you hear and you want to support it, there are two ways you can do that. You can go to DennisAnyone.net and you can leave a tip in my virtual tip jar. I feel like there should be a sound effect there, like ka-ching or like coins landing in something. Anyway, pretend there's a sound effect there. You can do that at DennisAnyone.net. Help me cover my expenses. I really appreciate that. Or you could become a subscriber to DNR Studios. I'm part of a group of shows under the Derek and Romaine banner. And for a monthly fee, you get my show early and you get all these other great shows as well. So you can learn about that at dnrstudios.com. I'm noticing as I'm doing this intro, I'm looking across my room and I have three cartoons of Olivia Newton-John on these lockers that I have for storage in my room, kind of like a dresser. They were all drawn by Glenn Hansen, a brilliant illustrator who has actually been on the podcast before. And there's one of her as Physical, which I wore that album out in 1981 and 82. Then there is Sandy and Danny in Greece, amazing. And then, of course, there is Kira from Xanadu. I'm looking at it right now as I do this intro. So what you're going to hear now is a special episode of Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife. They invited me on to talk about Xanadu, which I could do all day. And that's what you're going to be hearing with Dave White and Alonzo Duraldi. You're going to hear their fun theme music first. So that's how we're going to kick things off. But here is the episode. Enjoy.
Knife presents More Linoleum Knife.
Xanadu.
And for the first time in a very, very, very long time, we have a guest on this particular episode.
Not just any guest.
Of Linoleum Knife presents More Linoleum Knife. I can't even pronounce the name of my own show. He's not just any guest. He is a certified Xanaduologist.
Oh, for sure.
And he's one of our dearest, oldest friends. Not only is he very old, like us, but we've known him a long time. And his name is Dennis Hensley. Welcome to you, Woo! Dennis Hensley.
great to be here. Thank you guys for having me and thinking of me when this movie came up.
You are, in fact, the first person I think of when I think of the film Xanadu, even before I think of Olivia Newton-John.
I think of you. All right. Thank you. I appreciate it.
You're the one who made Dreams Die t-shirts to wear at the Outfest sing-along, and I'll never forget it.
Well, we all, and I think the front said Xanadude in the font, one word, Xanadude. And there were a lot of people wearing them. There was a big group.
It was a hot yeah. Weather. So, the reason that we turned to this was because, as you might know, the Criterion Channel this month is doing a tribute, to the Razzie Awards and are playing several films that were big winners there. And it's a strange mix of things because you've got films like Fassbinder's Carell and The Blair Witch Project that are pretty much generally acknowledged to be, you know, great films. You've got films that have their defenders like Showgirls and Ishtar and Xanadu. And actually, Xanadu and Can't Stop the Music were apparently among the key, the main drivers of the existence of the Razzies in the first place. But I just, you know, I will watch Xanadu again at the drop of the hat. And if I could watch it on the Criterion Channel, I kind of had to. So I just gave it another look. Now, Dennis, does your history go all the way back to 1980 or were you a latecomer on this one?
No, I was right there at the beginning. I love Olivia Newton-John. I loved her so much. And so I remember when the singles were coming out, Xanadu and Suddenly and Magic. And I had the 45s. And I remember cutting out the review from the Arizona Republic of Xanadu when it opened. And you want to know the headline?
Please.
I have it memorized. Xanadu spirits you away with video flair.
Oh.
Ooh. It was true then and it's true now. It's true now.
This is before the existence of MTV, so I'm not even sure what video flair means in 1980.
Well, it means when somebody gets Xanadu'd, which is when an outline appears around your body and you get whisked to another dimension.
Of course. doing oral, A-U-R-A-L.
Yeah. And there's a sound that goes with it.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
What about those wipes? You know what I mean? They hold up. If that was an app on TikTok or something, I would use it every time. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that is one of the many ways that the movie is sort of trying to have one foot in the now sound of the 1980s and one in the sort of trad musical of the 1940s, from the casting of Gene Kelly to the really comes together in the big dancing number where the big band with the trio of female singers who are all Olivia Newton-John, I assume, meld with the tubes. In a way that, again, shouldn't work, but does.
Well, also, it's practical. Like, you see the two sets coming together. It's not like something they did in post or whatever. It was like, oh, those two sets are sliding into each other. I can't believe this.
Like, tongue and groove, I think, is what they call it when it's flooring, you know.
Yeah. Yes.
So this film was produced by Larry Gordon, who went on to make Predator and Die Hard. And Joel Silver, who partnered with Larry Gordon for Predator and Die Hard, but also produced Hudson Hawk and The Matrix. So,
you're underselling Joel Silver.
I know.
He was like, if a movie could have a premiere party at Planet Hollywood, it was a Joel Silver movie.
Yes.
The big action epics of the late 80s were all him.
But back in 1979, he was just, you know, a young exec, and he was determined to remake a 1947 Rita Hayworth movie called Down to Earth. And the quote that I read about his fervor for getting this made was, he is prepared to stab myself in the back to get it going.
Wow. Now,
Rita Hayworth played Terpsichore, who is the character that Olivia Newton-John plays in this.
Kira.
And so Gene Kelly in Xanadu also plays a character named Danny McGuire in a 1944 movie called Cover Girl.
Opposite Rita Hayworth.
Opposite Rita Hayworth. Now, there was this idea that they could take the success of Grease.
Yes.
On multiple levels, not just the stardom, the sudden immense film stardom.
Movie stardom.
Of Olivia Newton-John, but also the idea that Grease brought into the world, which was, we can take something really old and make it contemporary by kind of zhuzhing it up in a variety of ways. What if we took the idea of the old Hollywood musical and made it roller disco?
So you're saying ELO is this movie's Barry Gibb?
Yes.
Gotcha.
Yes. And so the concept was sort of similar. Like, look, Grease was blat meets blat. Right. And Xanadu can be blah meets blah, and it's going to work the same way. And then it didn't.
How many times did you see it in the theater in the first run, Dennis?
Well, I probably saw it a couple of times the first time, and then sometimes it would pop up again. I remember it showing in my hometown of Holbrook, Arizona at the Roxy Theater. And I think I was home from college. It was well after it came out. And it was a double feature with Grease 2. And yeah, and the power in the whole town went out during Xanadu. And Grease 2 had already played. And we waited in the theater and it was pandemonium with everybody throwing things. You couldn't see 2 inches in front of your face, pitch black. It was such a good memory because we were just giddy with the silliness of throwing licorice. And then we all got ushered out and the manager said we couldn't get refunds because it was an act of God. And I thought, Xanadu's not great, but I don't know if God would step in. But well, yeah, that I have a million memory. I have more memories around Xanadu than the actual movie. I came to Palm Springs yesterday to do a show, and on my way I stopped at Hank's Bagels because my friend Jack loves them, and he lives out here. And my favorite counter person was working, and I recognized her because she used to work at a place I loved called T-Pop. And I said, you used to work at T-Pop? And I go, nice to meet you, I'm Dennis, what's your name? She goes, it's Kira. And I And I said, oh, like Xanadu. And she goes, oh, yeah, I was named after that movie. I said, oh, it's one of my favorites. I know. This happened yesterday. And she goes, oh, I've never seen it. And I was like, I couldn't form a sentence. But when I eventually could, I said, give me your Instagram. When it is showing at Vidiot's or New Bev or wherever, I am going to reach out to you. And you're going to be welcomed into a fold of middle-aged gay men. And you will understand your birthright. It'll be like Simba. But not on DVD. Maybe Criterion. Maybe. But I feel like it should be an outing.
Oh, so, for sure.
Long story short, I have Akira in my life as of yesterday.
Wow. She skated into your life. Well, it's funny. I have never seen the official Broadway musical. There was a Williamsburg Theater Festival stage version that they were doing in L.A. for a while. It was very funny.
But it was amazing. I saw that one. That was really great.
Oh, yeah. I saw that with you at least twice.
Yeah, down in Culver City. Great memories. Yeah,
exactly. But the Broadway version, there is a joke in which somebody in the show refers to the movie as children's theater for gay men. Yeah.
And it is. She rides that Pegasus across the sky. You want to hear my story about Xanadu the musical?
Yes,
of course.
Okay, so I saw it in Broadway and loved it. And then I saw it in Orange County with some friends. And in Orange County, I got to sit on the stage. Like a few people in the audience got to be kind of sitting around in this Greek set, like as, I don't know, Greek people or whatever. And there was one bit where the side muses... And I forget the name of the actress. I feel like her name was Mary something. Danny, do you remember the name of the actress?
Annie Golden.
Annie Golden. Danny's with me. And he knows. Okay, so we're all there. We're on the stage, so we're basically part of the show. And there's one bit where there's some drama happening between the main characters, and so the sidekicks decide to start passing around popcorn. Like, oh, we're eating popcorn and watching the scene. So they pass it to me, and then I'm not sure what to do with it. So I start to Annie Golden takes it from me, and I don't know whether to let go. I don't know what I'm meant to do in the scene. And she goes like this. She goes, "Let go." I shudder to think about it still. I have nightmares about it. It was so chilling that it almost ruined Xanadu for me, but not quite.
By that point in the run, she had had it with the gays on stage, I'm sure.
She had it. We didn't know what to do with the popcorn. I'm sorry. I didn't audition for this shit. I don't know if I can say that. You guys have a clean podcast, but anyway.
That's fine. Don't worry about it.
All right. Let go.
Now, Alonzo.
Yes.
Do you have a memory of seeing this film in the theater in 1980?
Crazily enough, I know for a fact that I did not.
Really?
And I don't know why, because okay. I certainly saw Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
Right. We all did. Yeah.
For some reason, I remember loving the songs on the radio, but I just never felt compelled to go see it. So I don't remember
the first time
I saw it.
Could it be that you were such a review-driven kid that you heard the reviews and were like, I guess I'll skip this one?
Maybe I saw like Siskel and Ebert trash it or something. And yeah, I did not see it.
I was living in a very tiny New Mexico town, Roswell, and we had very few.
You saw whatever came to town.
I just went to the movies. Yeah. Like, it didn't matter what was playing. I went because we had very few screens in the city. I think a grand total of 5. We had 2 twin cinemas and 1 big screen in downtown. And I went with one of my good friends one night to see it. I mean, like opening weekend. And the theater was empty. Like there was maybe 1 or 2 other people on a Saturday night. Like word of mouth had already somehow been that deadly that no one was there. And when there's no one in a theater with you to watch Xanadu, it is, especially when you are 16, 15, and it's your first time, you know, it's first run, you don't know what you're going to get. There's a lot of dead air in this movie, and you begin to feel like you have been cheated. We walked out of it at the end, we were like, you know, and that wasn't and the weird part about it was that we both enjoyed the music, you know, the ELO songs in particular.
Yeah.
And we were both, you know, fans of Olivia Newton-John because much like Isaac Mizrahi says about Mary Tyler Moore in Unzipped, I'm not made of stone.
I'm American.
You have no choice in life, I think, really. It determines whether or not you go to heaven or hell, I think, if you like or dislike Olivia Newton-John. But I remember walking out of it going, no. So it took me a long time. It took me meeting you.
Oh, wow.
To start to slowly warm up to it again. Because I remember when we met, you were like, oh, I love Xanadu. And I was like, why? and over time, I grew to understand its pleasures. Yeah. And now I fully do understand its pleasures. There are many of them. But anyway, Alonzo or Dennis, maybe you two could collaborate. What is this movie about? For the people, I guarantee you, there are people listening who have never seen Xanadu.
Fair enough. All right. So we meet a young artist who has quit his corporate job recreating album covers for billboards.
Played by Michael Beck.
Played by
Michael Beck. Warriors.
Hot off the Warriors. Yeah. And they're like, well, let's see. He's the happening guy. We'll put him in this. He'll be perfect. He is not. But nonetheless,
we don't care that he has a goony face.
He feels blocked and frustrated. And so he says dreams die, he tears up a thing he's painting, throws the pieces in the wind, and those pieces land on a giant mural. Turns out in earlier drafts of the script, we find out that Sonny Malone, the artist, painted that mural, but the movie never really addresses that. Anyway, that mural comes to life. It's the nine muses of, you know, Zeus's daughter who inspire, you know, music and literature and whatnot. And they all go, as Dennis says, they all have an aura around them, and they go zooming off into the sky, except for Olivia Newton-John as Terpsichore, a.k.a. Kira, who goes roller skating into Santa Monica, where she literally bumps into Sonny and gives him a kiss. And he becomes obsessed with her and chases her down, meanwhile becoming friends with Danny McGuire, a former big band leader turned financier who longs for the old days. And she convinces these two dudes to put their time and effort into something that's going to last forever, a glitzy roller disco in Los Angeles, and they do. That's the plot.
That's the plot. Roller disco at the time. Alonzo and I think, are both mutually obsessed with roller disco. Yes. Maybe I'm a little more obsessed with it. We live down the road from Los Angeles's former premier roller disco rink, Flippers,
which now a CVS,
became an Esprit store in the 80s, and now
it's like the flagship Esprit
is store. Now a CVS. Yeah, and if you drive past it, you can still see where the Esprit sign used to live, because the letters are like in the cement.
Yeah,
and that place was ground zero. Like, that place was where Cher was photographed wearing that absolutely see-through top while she was roller discoing. She was, at the time, sort of the primary celebrity ambassador for roller disco.
Yes.
And it was because roller skating had become this big craze for some reason, again, on the heels of the mid-70s skateboard boom.
I'm not a historian, but I'm going to guess that it's thing to do with the silicone wheels or something.
The wheels had become upgraded and were no longer metal, and it was the deal with the skateboards as well.
Yeah,
and so, but skateboarding was a big deal in the mid-70s, and so I think someone was like, "Well, what if we just do? What if we just make roller skates happen again?" Disco was gigantic, and these two things came together. You know, kids were going to roller rinks in small towns, I guess in big cities too. And disco was like the perfect soundtrack for a roller skating afternoon if you were in middle school.
Yes. And,
hence the song Good Times by Chic, which references roller skates. Getting back to Cher, there is a song. She released a single called Hell on Wheels, which is an entire roller disco themed song anthem. Go to YouTube and watch the video. There is more, like, gay porn stars of the era in this video. It's crazy.
Dennis, was roller disco hot in Arizona when you were growing up?
Not really. I wasn't very into roller skating. I skateboarded a bit. I was not great at it. But it was aspirational. We all wanted to be able to do it because of those movies. But I will say this, Michael Beck is a decent skater.
He is.
He carries the skating and suddenly with aplomb. And I also want to say that I used to think it was preposterous that some artist would abandon his creative career to open a club. But having had to pivot in my creative career so many effing times, if somebody said, "Hey, do you want to never open your laptop and type anything ever again and open up this roller disco with me?" I would be all over it.
Yeah. Yes.
It is not as preposterous as it seems.
I fully understand everything you're saying.
Fully, totally fair. I get it. Yes. No question.
Yeah.
So what this film has in common with sort of every other musical movie of its moment and of, you know, sort of pop culture in general, like Can't Stop the Music,
which Olivia turned down to do this movie.
Yes. The Apple, which was an even smaller thud of a flop than Xanadu, and even cheaper than Xanadu.
Yes.
Sgt. Pepper, which had a big budget and a huge cast. There was this idea that the 80s were going to be something entirely different than what they became.
Yeah.
Like, it's impossible to predict the future. But this film and other musicals of its moment had this idea that we were simply going to overlay new hair and clothes onto a disco aesthetic, right? So in some ways, that did happen. So with the emergence of synth pop in the 80s, but that music had a darker current running through it.
Yeah.
It was borrowing from punk and post-punk rather than disco's, you know, R&B birthed, you know, genesis. But in general, the 80s upended so much of what was becoming acceptable and enjoyable in the 70s. This is all because of Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, who were evil people, and they're actually in hell. Everything got dark really quickly.
I had a category in my book, 101 Must-See Movies for Gay Men, that Xanadu and The Apple and Can't Stop the Music are all in, that I called 1980 is 1979 plus nothing. Because all of these movies have this notion that, like, all of the outrageousness of the me decade and the fashion and the music was just going to go further in that direction. And they did not see Katrina in the waves coming. Did not see how the general dialing back of everything in the culture to this sort of conservative 50s level.
Right. And it's not impossible, obviously, in hindsight, to see what they were going for.
Oh, sure.
And what happened, like I said, they were setting themselves up on this grease template of old meets new. Present vintage things as contemporary.
Yeah.
So I know in your upcoming book, and I don't remember if this line got edited out of your upcoming book, but you described Grease as a parody of heterosexuality.
That's still in there.
Xanadu is the same thing.
Well, yeah. You have a couple that falls in love because they keep telling you they're in love, but they never have a real conversation about anything.
And Xanadu is kind of the spawn of Grease.
Yeah.
But it is also sort of a parody of life itself. It didn't just dare to reach back to the 1950s. It dared to reach back to Singin' in the Rain, and they had this audacity to cast the legendary Gene Kelly in this film and throw him into the Fiorucci store on Melrose and a roller disco and juggle bowling pins over his head, and he seems delighted to be there. Like, who wouldn't be? Like, you can imagine Gene Kelly going home or talking to his old friends and being like, this is the dumbest thing that has happened to me in decades, and I am so excited to be doing it, you know?
Between Xanadu and being a the dance consultant at American Zoetrope, like,
right.
Gene Kelly got involved in a lot of, like,
late career wildness. Night,
like, crazy. But he was, look, they were asking. The phone was ringing.
That's, and he seemed so happy to be a part of it. Like, that guy is always smiling. He knew from the moment he started dancing in film that his job was to grin while he did it. And everyone, just like Olivia Newton-John, who doesn't love him?
Yeah.
It's the perfect combination of people to be in this movie that found weird ways to use both of them.
Everything you say, I think of another Xanadu story. So
yes, please, go.
There was a period of time in the 90s when I would have clubs at this place in Los Feliz called Pedro's Grill, like Oscar parties. And then I just started doing clubs. And I did one called Club Xanadu. And I remember sending out the flyer, and the flyer was that famous still from Xanadu of Gene Kelly, like with his arms open, like gesturing on roller skates.
Yeah.
Well, while those postcards were in the mail, Gene Kelly died.
Oh.
So everybody was getting a postcard from this guy.
I remember getting mine in Dallas and calling you.
This icon the dice. I had totally forgotten about it. But also, there were whenever there's like a revival screening, I try to go, and at a lot of them, Gene Kelly's widow was there and would talk. Like, she showed up at a lot of those things. Yeah. So it must have been a project that he felt good about, or I don't think she would show up unless she just wanted to get out of the house.
Right.
The other one was, there was a birthday party that I had, and they happened to be having a screening of Xanadu in Glendale at the Alex Theater. So that was my birthday. Maybe there was a Chevy's outing before or after, because it was right across the street.
Right.
So we're all in there. We're all excited. And then the dancing number starts, and real live dancers start dancing on the stage, mimicking the show, move the movie, move for move. I thought my head was going to explode. I was this is my birthday. I didn't know that was going to happen. And move for move, and it was just incredible. And then at the end of the show, I went and sort of befriended some of the dancers. I was like, oh my God, that was amazing. Long story short, they did it again a few years later, and I got to be in it.
Oh,
I wore a purple suit that I had made during my cruise ship days that no longer buttoned at the waist, but I faked it. And I was in the 40s part, and there was rehearsal. I did get paid, and we danced in front of Xanadu. And I remember Tom Ford, our mutual friend, saying at the end that he kind of wished that I had died right at the end of it, because nothing is ever going to be better. He could see it on my face. He was like, that was your peak. That's as good as your life's ever going to get, was the subtext. It was thrilling. And it turns out one of my good friends was in the current friends was in the other section, but we didn't really know each other then because we didn't rehearse together.
No, I was with you on the birthday night, and that was magical, and none of us knew that was coming. And
none of us knew what was going to happen. And then the wife, the widow, was there. It was just like, oh my gosh, it was just incredible. Yeah, that was magical. And there should be more movies where they have dancers come out. I think it was really a cool thing.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, but
my last year running the film festival in Dallas, I was very like, all right, screw it. I'm going to do what I want. And so I booked Friday and Saturday midnight movies of Can't Stop the Music and Xanadu. And people came.
Yeah, they did.
People came and had a great time.
People love Xanadu. They do. They just love it. It's just – it's got such a sweetness to it. Also, Olivia was never more beautiful. Never more beautiful.
Right.
Yeah.
And she's always beautiful. And when – she sings Suspended in Time. One take, Newton-John. They don't call her that for nothing.
And Suddenly is one of my favorite musical numbers. Like, would it have been better if they had cast her opposite somebody who actually sang and they did the number as a singing roller skating number together? Of course. But I'll take Cliff Richard overlay at any day. It's fine.
I think there is something beguiling about a great bad movie.
Yes.
You want to see it again, if for no other reason than to study it, you know, to figure it out. And any truly, and we're going to call this a bad movie because that's its legacy, right? A bad movie that everyone adores.
Yeah.
Okay. But a truly memorable bad movie. I'm not talking about a mediocre, mushy, whatever, who cares, boring thing. I'm talking about a big swing that exploded in weird ways, right? Any truly memorable bad film invites that. And with a musical that fits into that character, that category, there's this added cognitive dissonance, I guess, where you've got songs that you kind of genuinely love, and maybe the production numbers around them in the film are fascinating to look at. And you have to reconcile those opposing forces in your head and your heart, right? So, like, the romance elements of this film still send me out of the room to get a snack, right?
Ooh,
the Michael Beck, see, any scene with him in it, I think I'm not interested in anything you have to say. But the musical numbers with the skating and the effects, the neon, you know, aura effects that they have, which are adorably cheap. And
I think you're talking about the video flare.
The video flare. Yes. And I'm talking about the video flare.
Public headline.
And the moment once you get through the first 30 minutes when there's finally a musical number, then for me, it all becomes very exciting. You know, when they go into the Fiorucci store and everyone is sort of suddenly neon colored and new wave and you don't know why, because up until that point it's been very Three's Company. You know, we're on the Santa Monica Pier and Olivia's got on this peasant blouse and you're thinking, okay, that's the 70s I know. Suddenly they're in Fiorucci and it's a whole new planet that they're on, and I just kind of love the idea of Gene Kelly being whisked around a retail in shop to an ELO song. It makes you want to do something you don't even understand what it is you want to do. Like it's when a little kid gets so excited all they can do is spin around in a circle. That is what that moment does. That is what that moment does. And the finale I still find intoxicating. I don't think it's shot very well. Like there's a frantic quality to it where you don't ever land on anybody for long enough to see all the work they've put into, you know, choreographing it.
Yeah.
But the spinning, dizzy quality of it, you know, Baz Luhrmann was looking at that and going, someday I'm going to make something kind of just like that. Like this last...
I'm going to make people skate in circles,
this too. Last 15 minutes of this movie, I'm going to make a whole movie that's like that. And then he did.
That's true.
Yeah. And so...
The Xanadu mega mix at the end where, like, the eight different songs wedged together.
Yeah.
That totally presages the opening number of Moulin Rouge.
It absolutely does. So,
and a lot of those songs aren't on the soundtrack, unfortunately. Right.
To this day, I know.
Don't you have a bootleg soundtrack, though, that's got all that stuff on it?
I don't.
I swear you do.
Maybe? I might. Yeah. But that needs to be a real one.
Yeah. So anyway, haven't you both interviewed Olivia Newton-John at various points in your careers?
I have, but Dennis, you go first.
I did a phoner with her once. Okay. And here's the thing. When somebody is so... close to your heart, you kind of bungle it, or you just like. I didn't bungle it, but it was. I do remember her saying something about roller skating that she hurt herself really badly.
She did.
We talked about roller skating. It was a phone interview for a radio show, so it was quick. But I do remember meeting her after a screening of Sordid Lives at Outfest, and I was with two other friends, Leslie and Richard. And we were all going to go up at the end and have our moment. And I think we were kind of subtly competing with each other to see who could have the best moment. My Leslie goes first and he's like, my sister and I used to listen to your 8-tracks in our basement. And I was like, I don't think I'm going to do that. Feels like that's not the move. That's going to make her 8-tracks. Really? So
I just
remember I talked to her about Sordid Lives and like nothing memorable. I was trying to honor the work she was there to promote.
Yeah.
And then my friend Richard goes, you know, there's a song on your album Gaia that really helped me when I was coming out. So he went for a deep cut and told her about coming out and how this song from that album, I can't even remember what it was called. It was like a tree growing strong. I don't know. Really helped him when he was coming out. And she got a little emotional. She was like, oh, that's so sweet. And you could just see them connecting. And he basically won.
Yeah.
And I said, you know what, Richard, I have to give it up to you. You really won with your story. He's like, yeah, I made that up. And I was like, you can't. I mean, I think he embellished. He didn't make it all up, but.
Yeah, because no one has the Gaia album. And if they do, they don't remember it.
Yeah. It was about Let Me Grow Strong. What the heck's that song? Anyway, it changed his coming out, and it was it was meaningful, and that was my Olivia interaction. Of course, she was lovely, but I feel like I didn't nail it.
My ONJ story is also Sordid Lives adjacent, because I interviewed her and Del Shores together for The Advocate when the movie was coming out, and... Del was like, oh, let's meet at this restaurant, at this place that he and Olivia apparently would go and hang out. And it was on Ocean Avenue in Santa Monica. So we get there and we go in the back where we're like facing the ocean. And I look across the street and it's that white railing.
Yeah.
Yep.
And so before the interview starts, I just go, didn't you skate like right there in Xanadu? She's like, oh, yeah. But, yeah, she was lovely.
So good, right?
I never met her. So I'm very sad about that. Because she is, I believe, I mean, if we're asking the question, this film that is considered to be a bad film by so many, like...
Authorities,
you know... She's the reason. She's the reason.
Oh yeah.
She is. It's silly to say this word because it's the name of a song, but she's magical in this film. Whatever she had in Greece, that pure sweetness, was like kicked up to a whole other level for Xanadu. There is something so graceful and so welcoming and so loving about not just her character, but you get that feeling about her as a person.
She's not a wide-eyed naif from Australia. She's a wide-eyed naif from Mount Olympus.
Yeah, you can't not feel embraced by her.
Yeah.
No matter what you think about the movie itself or its qualities, she's the driving power of this film. And those incredible ELO songs. I mean, those are wonderful songs.
And the other thing that she did mention to me about Xanadu was that getting to dance with Gene Kelly is just like a thing that she kept with her entire life.
Yeah.
That was like such a great moment. And you get it. And it is fun to watch that moment because you can tell that maybe he's dialing it back a little, like he didn't force her through like weeks of rehearsal like he would do to Sid Charisse or something.
Right.
But like he is a good dance partner to her. She is both giving it her all and thrilled to be doing it. And so
yeah.
It's a delight to watch.
You're referring, of course, to the Whenever You're Away From Me number, which was shot in long takes. Like they're not cutting around Olivia. The choreography is something that's in her wheelhouse. She does it with charm. They're wonderful together. It's one of my favorite songs in the movie. Did any of these songs get nominated for an Oscar?
No.
Shockingly, no.
None of them did.
The album was a huge hit.
Yeah,
they were all over the radio. Back then, you could have songs from movies be big hits.
Yep.
Yeah.
It happens sometimes, but not as much as back then.
And it's not like there wasn't a precedent for flop movies generating a best song nomination or even win because, you know, they were just coming off of Last Dance winning for Thank God It's Friday a couple of years earlier. So,
right.
But by the way, after you go to YouTube to find the Cher roller skating song, go listen to ELO's version of Xanadu where Jeff Lynne sings the lead vocal.
Right.
It's a cool little footnote.
It is, but you can't, it can't compare to her singing it. If I may be a little film critic-y for a moment, this is a real Los Angeles plays itself movie.
Mm. Yes.
Tom Anderson's 3-hour documentary essay film, Los Angeles Plays Itself, is all about the ways in which the physical, geographical city of Los Angeles has been used in films and or depicted in films or standing in for other cities.
Yeah.
It covers the whole gamut. And if you hear me say 3 hours and you think, oh, that's too much, oh, no.
No.
It's intoxicating. It's
delicious.
You want to watch this movie. If you do it in 20-minute chunks, it won't be any worse or better than if you sit through the whole thing at one time. But there is an iconic piece of Los Angeles architecture featured prominently in this film. It's the Pan Pacific Auditorium, which was, if you go look it up on the internet, you'll read all about it. It was a glorious looking place that by the 80s had fallen into complete disrepair. And so when they call it a dump in the movie and they're standing in front of it and it's covered in graffiti, that's the real place.
Yeah, and Gene Kelly's right. They did used to have wrestling there.
Yeah, they did used to have wrestling there. And so by turning that place into Xanadu,
this Art Deco palace.
I feel like the movie was sort of like wishing something into the future that never came to pass because eventually it burned down.
Although there is a recreation of its very famous sort of the front architecture at California Adventure.
Yeah, and there's still a little like a mini replica of the facade in the Fairfax District over in that area. I don't know where. I've seen
it was behind the post office on Beverly.
Yeah.
Basically, that area.
Yeah.
Before it burned down.
So, one of the things that Tom Anderson says in Los Angeles Plays Itself, he says, the best films about Los Angeles are, at least partly, about modes of transportation. Getting from place to place isn't a given. And that's what this movie's about, too, because everyone roller skates everywhere. So roller skating all over Los Angeles.
Hanging off the back of vans.
Yeah. So anyway, Let people tell you that this is a bad movie. You've got ammunition to tell them that it's not.
I do want to circle back, though. This is a thing that's both good and bad about the film. Dennis is absolutely right about the way that they shoot whenever you're away from me, because it's like you see two dancers head to toe in long shots, like they're really doing it. It's not chopped up together the way so much dance is on film now.
Yeah.
At the same time, that same dead-on eye-level viewpoint doesn't work in like the big finale number.
Right.
Because the cinematographer almost never takes the camera up into the rafters. He's always down on the floor with everybody else. And
right.
So everything just becomes this big kind of mass of people, and it doesn't pop the way that it might have had they like played around a little with where they were shooting. You get those occasional like direct overhead shots, you know, that accentuate the lights on the floor that's spinning where Olivia and the Muses are performing. But beyond that, they don't really take full advantage of what they could be doing. You know, they don't Busby Berkeley it nearly enough.
I know its two main stars have passed away at this point in history, but I want someone to do an oral history book or long article about this film and cover it from all the angles that are possible to cover it from. And, you know, take whatever Gene Kelly or Olivia Newton-John quotes that exist in the world and sort of infuse them into it. And what I really want is for all of those dancers to be found and accounted for, because there are dozens and dozens and dozens of people in this film who danced and who
juggled. Are
out there somewhere.
I met a juggling girl. Yeah.
Didn't one of the juggling women write a book?
Yeah.
Yeah.
She did, but it was about something
else. Hillary something, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I interviewed
her last name.
Yeah.
But,
I want to say Carlip. Hillary Carlip? Is that right?
Don't quote me. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
That's
but,
right.
Like, I need to know who those dancers were. I need to know how many of the regular kids on Soul Train and American Bandstand auditioned to be in this movie. I need to know.
Although I have to say, like, not to be a downer, but I always get a little skittish about.
Yeah, I know what you're about to say.
Well, whenever I see a musical made between like 1977 and 1982, and I'm thinking, like, how many of the men are still with us?
I again, wishes into the future. I always, when I see those guys dancing, I think, I hope you're still here.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, Matt Lattanzi could tell a tale.
If he's That's there. True.
That's where he and Olivia met.
They did. And yeah. They have lots of little moments together in the movie.
Yeah.
Alonzo, do you remember at the Outfest sing-along that they did not do the captions under the song Suspended in Time?
I always tell this story.
They did it for every other song. And then that song, which is, I think, an underrated gem of the movie, maybe my favorite song.
So, yeah, they're screening the film, and every musical number is subtitled for sing-along ability. And we get to Suspend the Time, and there's no words on screen. So Dennis Hensley, bless his heart, starts blurting out every line really fast before Olivia sings it so that we can sing along. So whenever I hear that song now, my first thought is you going, Child of a Fool Am I?
I didn't remember if I did that or if I had the instinct to do it and
did it.
I did it. So I was going like, child and a fool in one.
Yeah.
So sure, I could need no one.
Yeah. Yes.
Spending in time with you.
It was a public service and we appreciated it.
I stepped up. I fucking stepped up. Thank you. I also want to say that this movie is such a touchstone that Jennifer Lopez quoted it in This Is Me Now by having the godly panel of Zodiac people in the sky.
Yeah.
I did not make that connection, but I will grant that one. Yes, for sure.
Right? It's a very Xanadu-esque device. Yeah.
And weirdly enough, even though after this movie flopped, Olivia went for it again in Two of a Kind.
Yeah.
Where there's like a panel of angels who are like manipulating the action. And a much worse movie than Xanadu in that it is, I've tried twice to finish it and I can't get through it. It did give us Twist of Fate and Living in Desperate Times, but that movie is the worst. Whereas like Xanadu is a great bad movie that you can watch countless times.
You can't get enough of it. I will say this, every time I watch it, it gets better and worse.
Yes, I get that.
The record company scenes where they're talking in the office and Tuesday's Wednesday, they are rough, man.
Yeah, that dude with the glasses and the who's supposed to be like the comedy relief.
Ooh, yeah. They're rough. But that's because Olivia's not in them.
Exactly. The blonde lady in the record company scenes who does not sing or dance in this movie is part of the ensemble in the movie Godspell.
Interesting. All right.
And so when I was watching, I started watching Godspell again because TCM would always air it on Eastern. I have a fondness for the songs, even if I don't care for hippies or Jesus. And I was looking at this woman going, who is that? And then it's like, oh my gosh, she's in Xanadu in a non-musical role.
Okay. Do we have any final thoughts?
I'm looking at my post-it and I've crossed off
more stories. I'm sorry. I was talking over you. I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm looking at my post-it and I've crossed off all of my thoughts.
Okay.
Although my friend Danny, who I'm with, he has a bit that he'll often do when we go to live screenings, and it always kills, which is, Danny, do you want to describe your bit that you do? I don't know what I'm talking about. He's right here.
We're in a scene where Sonny is contemplating, and he's painting in the dark, and then the camera slowly moves around.
Yeah.
And then you see the highlight of her hair, and it's kind of spooky, so I was yelling, "She's behind you!"
it always kills.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
My final thought here is that if I've said it for years and I still stand by it, if you love Xanadu, I understand why, and if you hate Xanadu, I understand why, but it gives me much more delight than many a quality film. I'm gonna say that
I have entire friendships that are based on the fact that we both love Xanadu. Like, there is something, it has a place in my heart that is there. It's like, it's just timeless for me. And I love it so much. And I think it has a lesson for all of us, which is when all hope feels lost, the best thing to do probably is roller skate into a wall. Right?
It does seem to work.
I can't argue with that. No.
I also want to give a shout out to how short his shorts are in the movie. And whenever people try to quote it or they do the musical, they don't go as short because they don't have the courage. People don't have the courage to do 80 shorts right a lot of times.
Did Diane Jackson on Broadway?
Not short enough. I would say another inch on that inseam.
You should come to our block where we live, because currently those shorts are as short as they can possibly be.
They live again.
On many, many young men out walking their dogs.
They're back, and I love it. I support it. Yeah.
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 I have a special little fun fact for everybody before we sign off here. Alonzo.
Dave.
This is our 100th episode of Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife.
I can't think of a better way to spend
it. No, this is a great one.
I'm touched and honored. Thank you.
Dennis, where can people keep track of all of your fabulous comings and goings online?
They can listen to the Dennis Anyone podcast wherever they get their podcasts. It's about making things up and making things happen. A tagline provided to me by Alonzo Duraldi.
You're welcome.
I like to talk to creative people about their work, but also the journey of it, the ups and downs. And lately I've been crying in almost every episode. Yeah, that's cool.
It's a great podcast. Listen to it, y'all, if you've not. Dennis gets granular, but also funny. It's always great.
Thank you very much. So, yeah, we've been doing this a while, you guys. This is my 10th anniversary of Dennis Anyone.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, thank you for joining us today. We love you. So
we love you. I love you guys so much.
We want you back for some other reason on some other podcast.
We'll figure it out. Yeah. All right. Well, listen, thanks everybody for listening. Thank you as always for being Patreon supporters. We'll be back next time with more. Until then, goodbye.
Thank you so much to Dave White and Alonzo Duraldi for inviting me to be part of that episode. It was an honor and a thrill and so much fun to do. And you should check out their podcast. Linoleum Knife is the
typical flagship free podcasts that you can get wherever you get your podcasts. And there's also their Patreon page with all these other cool Linoleum Knife spinoffs. They've got it going on over there. So that's that. All right. So this happened. Olivia Newton-John passed away a couple years ago. And I didn't mention this on the podcast because there were so many other things we were talking about. But I do remember when that happened. I remember being in a Del Taco in my neighborhood when I heard the news. And of all the celebrities that have passed away in my lifetime, Olivia Newton-John hit me the hardest. That loss hit me the hardest of all of them. It really, like, you know, it was really something that I had to grieve. She meant so much, man. She was my girl all through high school, all through college and beyond. Soul Kiss, I hung in for the rumor. I was there. Gaia, I had them all. I just loved her. And when she passed away, I stocked my jukebox with all the Olivia 45s I could get my hands on, including Please Mr. Please, which is a really fun song to put in your jukebox because it talks about a jukebox. It's kind of meta. But I remember, I think I posted something on Facebook when she passed, something to the effect of, as I got older, I found that there were all these other gay guys that loved her as much as I did. And when I loved her in high school, it was just me. I was an island. But then you grow up and you realize, oh, this was happening everywhere with a certain kind of guy. And I met all these guys. And so I think I ended up posting on Facebook when she passed. I think gay men of a certain age loved Olivia Newton-John because she looked and sounded like an angel, but also because we felt like if she ever met us, she would like us. And we were right. I think that was my thought. And I think that's true. Like, you always felt like she would like you. Like, some divas, they're just there to be adored. Some of them you don't even want to meet. Like, you don't want to catch Madonna on a bad day. And I love Madonna. But, you know, like, or Whitney. Like, but you felt like if Olivia met you, she would like you. And I think that came through in her performances, in her interviews, in the way she interacted with her fans, you know, the meet and greet moments. Like, that was really something special. And so I just wanted to add that because I didn't get to say it in the actual podcast. But I will always love Olivia. Honestly, I'll honestly love her. All right, that's enough for this week. Thank you so much for listening. I want to give a shout out to Oscar Rosario, who helped mix the episodes. I don't know if he's doing this one because it's kind of a rush job, but we love Oscar. Also, my theme music is by Mark Daniels for Placement Music. We'll catch you next time on Dennis Anyone. Bye.